This message comes from NPR sponsor Carvana. With thousands of options under $20,000, plus customizable financing terms and down payments as low as $0 down, it's easy to find a car that fits your lifestyle. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today. Terms and conditions may apply.
Hey, it's Todd. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is constantly changing, and things might have changed by the time you hear this episode. Stay up to date with the news by listening to your local NPR member station and by visiting npr.org for all the latest. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show. You're listening to the 1A Podcast. I'm Todd Zwillick in for Jen White, and today it's a healthcare roundup, if you like. First, we'll check in on a major news story, a cyber attack on one of the biggest healthcare companies in the United States. It's disrupted pharmacies and hospitals throughout the country. Change Healthcare is owned by United Health Group. It's the biggest processor of medical claims in the whole nation. The unpaid bills are piling up, and doctors and pharmacists are warning that the disruption is harming their ability to even stay open. The Department of Health and Human Services revealed a plan to deal with the fallout from the attack. It encourages advanced funding to the hardest hit organizations. And the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services said that it's considering going back to a pandemic era plan of accelerated payments for individuals. How far can help from those federal agencies go? And what does this attack reveal about the security and the vulnerability of the largest healthcare companies in the United States? Later, we'll check in on rising drug prices, where and how abortion is showing up on the ballot, and discuss the end of the federal free at-home COVID testing program. We'll meet our panel of healthcare experts right after a break, so stay with us. We've got a lot to get into.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Across America, history is often recorded on small markers. You've probably seen them on the sides of roads, in front of buildings, in the middle of nowhere. NPR's Laura Sullivan spent a year investigating thousands of markers and found a distorted version of America's history, but also curiosities, humor, and joy. Listen to the new episode of The Sunday Story on the Up First podcast from NPR.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
All right, let's get into it. Joining us now is Dan Diamond. He's a reporter covering health policy at The Washington Post. Dan, always great to talk to you.
Todd, thanks for having me back.
Also with us is Anna Barry Jester. She's a global health reporter at ProPublica. Anna, it's great to have you.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
And Alice Holstein is here with me in the studio. She's a health reporter, a familiar voice at Politico. Alice, great to have you.
Thanks so much.
Dan, you're up first. This hack on United Health Group, which operations were affected? How big was this attack? What happened?
Well, I think there are a few things to explain here, Todd. The hack itself and then the impact. The hack targeted Change Healthcare, essentially a middleman on healthcare payments. They are a company owned by United Health Group, the biggest player in healthcare. And hackers last month got into Change Healthcare's system, encrypted its files, stole their data, demanded ransom. It froze operations. The company is not processing the tens of millions of medical claims that it normally gets every day from doctors and hospitals and others. Now, it does appear that someone last week paid the hackers $22 million in Bitcoin, probably United Health, in an attempt to end that situation. But as we're talking, it's unclear where things stand on getting Change Healthcare back online, and that gets the impact. There are a huge number of doctors, hospitals, other health workers who have spent weeks waiting to be paid and warning that they are in financial distress. And there have been some implications for patients, not so severe yet, but you can see how if this continues, it could lead to canceled procedures and real disruption across healthcare.
Yeah, I want to circle back to that $22 million payment that you just mentioned that came from somewhere. put that thought on hold because that's a big one. Anna, how many patients affected? How many accounts? Give us a sense of the impact here.
Yeah, Change Healthcare is so large that it really impacts just about every provider in the country and every insurer. So, you know, they essentially are this middleman that they both take in the claims that are made by providers, and then they pass those through to the insurers. And so this touches on pretty much everyone's healthcare.
Pretty much everyone. I mean, these companies are so large that they're at the center of the private health industry.
That's right.
Alice, what's your sense of how big of a problem this is, this vulnerability?
Yeah. I mean, I think among other things, it just shines a light on how much consolidation there is in the healthcare industry and how, you know, a single company is so integral to the entire system that, you know, a hack like this, a well-timed, well-targeted hack can really, you know, bring things to a standstill across the industry. And so I think this is why you're seeing some calls, you know, not just for federal intervention to solve the short-term problem and make sure these payments start flowing again and people can get their prescriptions, but more long-term sort of antitrust, you know, breaking up some of these big companies. You're seeing more and more calls for that because they don't think a single entity should have this much power.
Dan, Alice raises an interesting point, the amount of consolidation that can lead to this. Consolidation like that increases vulnerability because there's one big, fat, juicy target, but also maybe increases the chances that that big, fat, juicy target will just pay the attackers because they got to get out of this. Now, you just mentioned $22 million that came from somewhere in Bitcoin. Talk more about that.
Well, first, United Health, the conglomerate, is not just a Fortune 500 company. It is a Fortune 5 company. They are about as big as it gets in the business world. They have not confirmed that they were behind the payment to this ransomware group. And the ransomware group itself has a habit of popping up and pulling down stakes and disappearing. So it's unclear whether the ransomware payment will even resolve the issue here, Todd. Some of the data that was taken from Change Healthcare appears to be data that may end up becoming public regardless of what ransom payment is made. So that speaks, I think, to the bigger issue that you're getting at, the idea that these are big targets, big juicy targets for hackers because of their size, the data, and their ability to make payments. I will say one interesting thing about Change. They were a big company even before being acquired by United a few years ago. They were already a big player before coming into the United universe. So it's not just United. There are these other organizations, but the fact that United is this choke point, and United was already facing an antitrust probe from the Department of Justice, the Wall Street Journal, and others have reported, this just puts a further spotlight on an issue that many Democrats especially have raised worries about.
Alice, 2022, the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, said the number of ransomware attacks like this one against hospitals, not healthcare systems necessarily, but hospitals, doubled from 2016 to 2021. Ransomware attackers and hackers seem to think they've got a pretty good plumb going with the U.S. healthcare system.
Yeah, it's interesting because the healthcare system gets knocked often for being very technologically backward and still relying on fax machines and, you know, paper forms in a lot of cases. But this also shows the danger of going in the other direction and having things be, you know, very connected and very very technologically advanced. And so I think this is prompting a real reckoning. And I think it's no surprise that that the ransom payment is shrouded in mystery right now, because there are many who feel that making these payments only incentivizes more hacks in the future.
Of course. That's always the dilemma, right? You have to get the system going again. Millions, tens of millions, who knows, hundreds of millions of patients and their doctors affected. On the other hand, the incentives are all clear. If you pay $22 million, we don't know who paid it. Somebody did, right? Anna, what lessons are insurance companies taking away from what happened here, if any?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say really quickly that this is just one of many, many healthcare hacking incidents that's happened. And, you know, and every day there's the same group is believed to be behind a hack at a children's hospital in Chicago last month. They also, the same group was blamed for hacking the Colonial Pipeline a couple of years ago. So this is not an issue that's going to go away. I think that providers feel like maybe not enough is being done to plan for how to deal with this going forward. And as we, you know, consolidate the healthcare industry, it's just a risk that that this is, they're just going to be bigger targets as time goes on.
Dan, you've been doing plenty of reporting on this, and you spoke to the CEO of Aledade, the country's largest group of independent primary care providers. And he told you that as many as 25% of practices are exhausting their cash reserves because the money isn't flowing. We mentioned at the top of the show that the federal government is trying to step in here. What are they trying to do?
So you're talking about Farzad Mostashari, the head of Aledade. Farzad is very unhappy with what the federal government is doing here. The federal government has tried to encourage the private sector, all health plans, not just United Health, to speed up their processing of payments because you have these hospitals and doctors and others who are just sitting around waiting to be paid through Change Healthcare, through United. And if there are other payments that could come into these providers, the federal government wants those to be expedited. The federal government has also said that it will pursue making loans available to hospitals. This COVID-era program that I think you mentioned in the beginning, Todd, that could help keep hospitals afloat. But they haven't done the same yet for physicians, and that's why Farzad and some other physician leaders are so upset, and members of Congress are beginning to speak out about this, that they feel that the physicians who have less financial security than the big hospitals, they're the ones who are really at risk. They're the ones like the, I can't remember who told me this week, Todd, but the idea that it's like a duck on the surface of a lake and everything looks placid, but below the surface, paddling furiously. And that's what many physician groups are doing. They are taking out emergency loans. They're doing everything they can to try to meet payroll because they are just so short on cash in many cases.
Well, American Physicians Group sounds like it's paddling furiously. We got this statement from American Physicians Group. The actions that the federal government has announced to help break the logjam on paying healthcare workers at this point pertains only to hospitals. It has not yet resolved the problems for American physicians. In fact, a fact that we know well since our members care for about one in four Americans. Alice, hospitals notoriously operate on extremely thin margins to begin with. Doctors less so, but also.
Yes. And so I think that's why even, you know, short-term disruptions, and it's not yet clear how short or long-term this will be, can really squeeze people. And, you know, you already have a crisis around the country of hospitals going out of business and closing their doors, especially in rural areas. And so there's a lot of stress.
A devastating hack on a major healthcare middleman in the United States. Millions of patients and their doctors affected. And a $22 million payment from someone in crypto to try to get things moving again. We're going to head to a quick break now. Coming up, the U.S. has some of the highest drug prices in the world. Who's trying to fight that? Are voters even aware of it? Back with more in a moment.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
If you've never donated to the NPR network before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days, coming up on May 1st and 2nd. Please give at donate.npr.org, and thank you.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest-growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get back to our healthcare roundup with this text we got from one of you. I have a rheumatological condition that requires meds at a rate of $100,000 per year, all because the drug companies have a corner on the market. I currently travel to Mexico to get my meds. It's 20% of the cost in the U.S., same box, same meds. It's made in Puerto Rico to boot. Biden is trying, but Congress gets too much benefit to change this status quo. That's a comment from one of you listening to this discussion on health and health policy. And it brings me to my point about politics and drug prices and healthcare. Alice, according to a recent poll by the Kaiser Family Foundation, 80% of voters polled said that healthcare affordability is very important for candidates to talk about. I used to be a health reporter as a younger man.
We'll get you back someday.
Maybe. You might, actually. Time and time again, every election, voters would say healthcare is super important, the most important issue to them. They don't necessarily vote on it when they get in the ballot box. That's the history of it. How is healthcare and cost showing up in the campaign so far?
Yeah, it's interesting because, the perennial focus on economics and kitchen table issues, healthcare fits right into that. It's for, you know, a lot of families, a huge part of their budget, a huge part of their spending. And that's, you know, drug costs, that's hospitals, you know, and, you know, we were talking about consolidation that leads to really high prices and costs for a lot of people. So this is clearly something Democrats want to lean into really hard going into the election. I mean, we know tonight it's going to be a big topic at the State of the Union. We have had that previewed, and also, you know, people inviting guests related to the topic. The Bidens have invited several guests who are on the drugs that are being negotiated right now, thanks to the policies supported by this administration. And so they clearly want to make a big push on this front going into the election. However, those lower prices, people won't see those by the time of the election. There's a really long timeline for the implementation of the Medicare price negotiation. And so, you know, the president can go out there and campaign on lowering drug prices, but people will say, wait a minute, I just went to the pharmacy to pick mine up. It's not cheaper.
Now, Dan, Alice is edging toward a point here. The Inflation Reduction Act, it has a lot of measures aimed at lowering drug costs for 66 million people enrolled in Medicare. And Alice mentioned it, Medicare price negotiation. Democrats have been chasing this, gosh, for decades. They finally got it. Medicare can now negotiate with Big Pharma over the prices of many expensive drugs. What is the plan? How is it working? And why is it so difficult for the Biden campaign, I'll say at this point, to make sure voters know about it?
Todd, are you just asking these questions as a recovering health journalist who needs to scratch an itch?
You never quite recover.
it is a lifelong addiction on this beat. I think that Alice has got it right. These are steps that are going to take some months and years to play out. The Biden administration has started negotiating with a handful of drug companies over expensive drugs. But even though they are trying to build up anticipation and attention, every time there is an offer made that we don't know the actual offer amounts, the Biden administration has been sending out alerts and trying to hold announcements and put energy on this. You might remember, as a recovering health journalist, this seems a little bit what happened to Democrats after they passed the Affordable Care Act in 2010. They had all of these things coming, but they couldn't campaign on it right away. It took some years to take effect. And I've seen this with my own eyes. I was in Ohio last month with Health Secretary Javier Becerra, the nation's top health official, and I watched as he tried to make the case that we in the Biden administration are doing all of these things on drug pricing. There are some people acutely aware of those efforts. We haven't really talked about it, but the Biden administration has worked to cap the cost of insulin, for instance. If you're diabetic and need insulin, that is something that has already taken effect. But beyond that, the drug price negotiation is still pretty theoretical, and the impact won't be felt for some time. The Biden administration does want to keep extending these policies, so there's a good chance that if we came back and did this roundtable in 5 years, we would have a lot to talk about. But right now, it's very much still in the planning and beginning of the execution phase, not in the results phase.
All right, 5 years, it's a date. Alice, go ahead.
Yeah, I think the Obamacare comparison is really apt because the implementation takes many years, but the attacks can come immediately. So you have the pharmaceutical industry already out there warning that these price negotiations will lead to decreased innovation and new drugs, new cures won't be invented to help your disease. And so people will hear that, but they won't feel the impact of the lower prices yet. And I think you saw that same tension with Obamacare. You had a lot of, you know, claims and attacks on it at first, and the benefits didn't kick until later.
And now all these many years later, more than, I guess, 13 years later, ACA, Obamacare is
popular. Very popular. More popular than ever. Yes.
Whoever would have guessed?
Right.
I mean, Obama guessed. It's what he said, that it would become entrenched and popular.
But Democrats paid a huge political price in the short term.
In the short term, right away. They sure did. They lost the House. They lost the Senate. It was a political disaster in the short term. That's so interesting. All right. Let's put drug prices to the side just for the moment. Anna, you have an important medical and vaccine story that you've been working on. Your recent investigation for ProPublica is on the rise in syphilis cases among infants and the shortage of the drug that treats the disease during pregnancy. Tell us more about that.
Right. So there's been an increase in syphilis over the last decade or so, but it's really reached crisis levels. The big concern is that when a person who's pregnant doesn't get treated, they can pass it on to their baby, and that can be life-threatening and also cause serious disability. So there's only one drug that can be used to treat people who are pregnant, and that drug is in shortage right now. It's in an official shortage. And I talked to, you know, clinics and doctors and health departments all over the country, and they say the shortage is just really more severe than it's been than has been expressed by the federal government. They are having, you know, seeing delays in treating people who are pregnant. They're concerned about not being able to use this drug, which is sort of the preferred drug for other people as well. And it's, you know, it's expected that there will be more of the drug in the third quarter of this year. But right now, they're still, you know, managing the shortage and really doling out the drug very carefully, meaning that lots of people aren't getting it. This is happening in the backdrop of a bigger problem with drug shortages. There's a growing number of drugs that are in shortage in the United States. And there's a couple of dynamics there. One is that while we pay a whole lot of money for, you know, drugs that are under patents, new drugs, more than any other country, in some ways we pay very little for generics. There's concerns about, you know, the muscle of the hospitals being able to drive prices down so much that companies can't afford to stay open with the small prices they're being paid for generics.
Well, we got this text from one of you right to Anna's point. I'm interested in the continued shortages of common treatments for ADHD, for asthma, for other conditions. It's hard not to think that the manufacturers or intermediaries don't see the demand and send prices further up. Supply chains should be fixed by now. That's a comment from one listener, Anna.
Yeah, there's been some efforts to try and fix the supply chains, but nothing that's worked so far. I mean, there have been hearings in the Senate and other things. This is an ongoing problem, and there's some very particular kinds of drugs that are impacted and by the shortage, that are more likely to have shortages. But so far, you know, there's calls for the federal government maybe to manufacture drugs or to do other things like that. But it has been, it's a tricky issue that has certainly not been solved.
And Dan, we talk every year perennially in this country about the price of drugs in America and why they're so much higher in the rest of the world. RAND Corporation found that U.S. drug prices over 2 times higher than prices in 33 other countries. Why are we such an outlier on this?
I think the short answer, Todd, is that we're an outlier on all healthcare prices. You can look at hospital prices, doctor bills, and so on, and everything is inflated here. But the long answer, some of it depends on who you ask. The obvious choice is that drug makers, they set their prices very high in the United States. They say that that's necessary to pay for the costs of R&D, but there are clear arguments for why those prices are inflated, especially when you look overseas. And then you talk to the drug makers, and they point their finger at pharmaceutical benefit managers, these middlemen that they say are inflating the system. The listener that you just mentioned talking about the cost of insulin and the devices, I have talked with Senator Bernie Sanders, the liberal Vermont senator, about this issue a number of times. And he blames the drug industry for tactics like trying to protect patents around drugs and devices in ways that push the price up artificially and lobbying extensively to try and protect their influence. So insulin as one example of a drug device combination that has been costly and expensive. Another one that is now on lawmakers' radar, inhalers. If you have asthma, for instance, they have started trying to put similar pressure on inhaler manufacturers the same way that there's been pressure around the cost of insulin.
Now, I mean, there's so much going on around reproductive rights. We can talk the rest of the hour about it, about abortion itself, about abortifacient drugs like mifepristone, about IVF. We've covered the story in Alabama. But there are also legal battles, Alice, over access to abortion pills in the states. Give us an update, quite apart from these over-the-counter contraceptives. give us an update on what's happening in states when it comes to abortion medication and legal challenges there.
Yes. So this is going to the Supreme Court later this month. And the Supreme Court is going to hear a challenge to policies making abortion pills more widely available. There are groups that want to turn back the clock so that you can only get the abortion pills directly from a doctor, and undoing more recent policies saying you can get them by mail, you can get them from a local pharmacy, and you can, you know, have an online doctor appointment and get them that way. And so this could make a huge difference in terms of availability. Obviously, many states have also passed their own bans, but this is going after the federal regulation. And so this would impact everyone in the country. Even if you live in a state where abortion is legal and protected, this could limit the availability of the pill there.
All right, let's take a quick break here. Still to come, the measles outbreak in some parts of the country is exposing the disinformation around vaccines and damaged trust in public health officials. Plus, the latest from a billion-dollar case of Medicare fraud. Back with more, just a moment.
Every time you drive your car, have a package delivered, or get on a plane, you're polluting the climate. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Nature is powerful. Why don't we use it to our advantage?
Meet the people working on cleaner ways to get around on Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR. Transportation Climate Solutions on Here and Now Anytime, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Let's get back to our healthcare roundup now with a text we got from one of you. I'm paying attention to measles in Florida due to the anti-vaccine crowd. Now, Alice, this is a critical story. According to the CDC, there have been 35 measles cases in 15 states in the United States, at least 8 cases in Florida. Florida's outbreak is the largest in the U.S., where the state's Surgeon General is actually under fire for his decision to let parents decide whether or not to quarantine their child in the face of measles. Meanwhile, in Ohio, they mandated a 21-day quarantine period for children infected with measles. Measles was a thing of the past, or so we thought. What's going on here?
So, yes, I mean, anti-vax sentiment was definitely brewing before the pandemic. It was, you know, it was on the right and the left. There was skepticism of vaccines. And, you know, I'm from California. I remember there being pockets of measles outbreaks there, you know, in sort of kind of hippie areas where people didn't want to vaccinate their kids. But COVID really supercharged that movement. It exposed it to a lot more people who were, you know, scared and looking, you know, looking for someone to blame and looking for answers. And so it just put this misinformation and ideology to a much, much bigger audience. And in some places like Florida, you have these top health officials, you know, sanctioning it and echoing it and doubling down on it. And so that is really fueling the fire right now.
Dan, we are in a position where top officials who should be trusted by the public are doubling down on disinformation when it comes to vaccine. Florida Surgeon General, Alice just mentioned, Joseph Ladapo, he rejected federal guidelines for COVID-19 vaccinations, which, in my view, sort of set the stage for this sordid return of measles in children now.
You know, Todd, I profiled Florida Surgeon General Ladapo as he emerged as this major COVID skeptic and was struck by how his professional path seemed to be going in one direction before sharply diverging. Just some background on him. He was a college athlete. His friends and colleagues described him as charming and charismatic, maybe a little contrarian, but obviously smart, a Harvard MD, PhD. He supported progressive causes like the Affordable Care Act. If you had said 5 years ago that he would become a health official in the Biden administration, I don't think anyone would have been surprised. And then the pandemic hit, and his contrarianism started inching toward anti-vaccine skepticism. He wrote op-eds in the Wall Street Journal raising questions about the pandemic response. That got the attention of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who liked what he had to say, brought him to Florida, made him the state's top health official. And I think, having spoken with Dr. Ladapo, like every effort he made to question COVID response and settled science pushed him further and further away from the consensus. And I want to be clear right now to underline the point, he stands alone on these issues. You mentioned the comparison with Ohio on measles. There's no other state surgeon general warning against taking COVID vaccines, for instance. So he has very much fallen out of favor with the public health establishment, even as he has won this devoted fandom in the anti-vaccine community.
And I reiterate, as we're talking about anti-vax sentiments, we're talking about children here who don't get a say in whether they want to protect themselves or not. We got this text. I'm worried about the anti-vaxxer movement. I work in international development and can say without a doubt that childhood vaccine protocols have made our children and our general population safer, and they are the envy of other countries. That's a text from one listener. Anna, what's your take on the return of measles in America?
Yeah, I think to understand what's happening in Florida and why it's so concerning to other health officials is it's helpful to understand sort of what typically happens when there's a measles outbreak. Officials interview the person who's infected, they find out where they've been, and then they take the very rare step of telling the public when and where that person was so that they know if they might have been exposed. And they do that for a few reasons. It's so that you might know if you've been exposed and you can isolate, but also to encourage people to get vaccinated. And in this case, not only are they not, is the Florida providing very scant information, so not encouraging people to get vaccinated, but they're saying that kids who are unvaccinated at this one elementary school where the outbreak, most of the cases have occurred, that they're not even suggesting that they have to stay home from school, which typically they would. So it's both the individual people who might have been exposed that are kind of at risk, but also there's a broader public health messaging that typically happens. And in this case, that's not.
Meanwhile, federal free home COVID-19 testing, where we could all get free tests by sending a message on a website, which I did. It's coming to an end. Rates of hospitalizations related to COVID are decreasing, but at least 17,000 people were hospitalized during the week of February 24. That's according to the CDC. That's still an extraordinary number for any measure of public health.
Yeah, there's still tons of cases of COVID out there. So not only did we stop handing out free tests this week, but the CDC also changed its guidelines on isolation for when you have COVID. You know, now they're saying basically when you don't feel sick and you haven't had a fever for 24 hours, you can go back to work and school, which is different from previous where they said to isolate for 5 days. Many people already felt the 5-day isolation was too short, and others feel like this is just responding to where we are and that a lot of people aren't testing anyways. And also there's a lot of immunity. So this has been a really contentious issue, I think, among all kinds of health experts about how to handle this. But the CDC is saying, you know, no, this is the right thing to do where we're at. And it is akin to sort of what's asked of people when they have flu or RSV or other respiratory infections.
There is no doubt the American public largely has moved on from COVID. It was a terrible time. But people who are in the hospital with the disease have not moved on. And it is still out there. Without question. Dan, we started the hour by talking about crime in the business of healthcare. And unfortunately, we have to circle back to crime in the business of healthcare because there is a developing story of massive Medicare fraud. House Republicans yesterday addressing an alleged Medicare fraud ring estimated at more than $2 billion, which has affected hundreds of thousands of patients. What happened here? What is this?
There was a spike beginning about a year and a half ago, Todd, in bills for urinary catheters. These are low-cost devices. They help people who have urinary incontinence. And overnight, Medicare started seeing a major surge in bills for these products, which historically had been used by maybe 40,000, 50,000 Medicare patients per year. But in 2023, they got bills for 400,000 patients. And the bills also soared from about $150 million that Medicare was billed every year to more than $2 billion last year. There is no medical reason. There is no change in these devices. There is nothing that would explain why this market would grow so quickly overnight, why so many patients would be ordering these devices, with the exception of that these are fraudulent orders. And the National Association of ACOs, a healthcare group, helped put a spotlight on this. They traced back the orders to a handful of companies that appear to be connected. They have some things in common in terms of staff and location that began billing Medicare overnight for these products. We at the Washington Post a few weeks ago confirmed that the FBI and other agencies are investigating. The FBI hasn't commented on that, but we have gotten some other federal officials to talk about the existence of that probe. And there are many seniors out there who are getting bills in the mail from Medicare for these products that they say they never ordered, they never wanted, never received. So it is a problem, and it is a massive amount of fraud. For context, the FBI has talked about a $1 billion fraud bust as among its biggest fraud schemes that they've seen. $2 billion plus at this point. Estimates said it might be close to $3 billion. That's a lot of money. Medicare may not have paid it all out, but it has caught the attention of lawmakers.
I want to thank these phenomenal guests, Anna Berry Jester, global health reporter at ProPublica, Dan Diamond, reporter covering health policy at The Washington Post, and Alice Holstein here in the studio with me, health reporter at Politico. As a reminder, 1A Plus is now available. When you join 1A Plus, you get to listen to our show sponsor-free. And you get to support our work. Go to plus.npr.org/the1A to find out more. Again, that's plus.npr.org/the1A. Today's producer was Arfi Getty, and this program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. I'm Todd Zwillick. We'll talk more soon. This is 1A.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
You care about what's happening in the world. Let State of the World from NPR keep you informed. Each day, we transport you to a different point on the globe and introduce you to the people living world events. We don't just tell you world news, we take you there. And you can make this journey while you're doing the dishes or driving your car. State of the World podcast from NPR. Vital international stories every day. You care about what's happening in the world. Let State of the World from NPR keep you informed. Each day, we transport you to a different point on the globe and introduce you to the people living world events. We don't just tell you world news, we take you there. And you can make this journey while you're doing the dishes or driving your car. State of the World podcast from NPR. Vital international stories every day.